Right. The first topic that we're going to discuss today is a new topic, a question on IAS 1. And I thought that I might just give... Excuse me, wait for a second. Sorry, my dog muffled. given that you will have seen this is a little bit unusual because the we haven't received a submission that's been used as the basis for the analysis, I thought I might just make a few opening comments, if I may. But first of all, actually, staff, do you want to tee up the paper first, or do you want me to give my comments first?
I'd like to start with my tee up.
Okay, Ken. So I'll hand over to you, and then I'll follow up with a few observations.
Thank you. Agenda paper 2 discusses classification of debt with covenants as current or non-current, applying the amendments to IS-1, which were issued in January 2020. The committee has not received a formal submission. However, based on the informal feedback and the inquiries received from stakeholders, we are bringing this matter to the committee. This paper discusses how an entity determines whether it has the right to defer settlement of the liability for at least 12 months after the reporting period in three fact patterns outlined in paragraphs 9 to 13. Paragraphs 18 to 36 present our analysis of how the entity classifies the liability in each case, and paragraph 37 summarizes our conclusion. In our view, the three cases, the entity classifies the loan as current because it does not have the right at the end of the reporting period to defer settlement of loan for at least 12 months after the reporting period. So I will now direct you to question 1 on page 12 of the paper and ask whether you agree with our analysis of the application of requirements in IFRS standards.
Thanks, Ken. And just before I hand it over to committee members, I just wanted to make a few comments and also to flag how I plan to run the discussion. So as Ken said, we didn't receive a formal submission that was the basis for this paper. But over the last few months, we have had a lot of conversations with people who are looking at these new amendments, which has made us aware that perhaps the change is bigger than what people had appreciated, and also there's more questions about confirming the application of the requirements than we had anticipated. And so we thought that it would be helpful for understanding and consistent application to bring this paper to the committee. So when you look at the paper, and if you look at the amendments to IAS 1, you will see that the board made these amendments. It had a couple of different objectives, but one of the key objectives was to make it more clear that IAS 1 requires an entity to assess whether at the end of the reporting period, based on conditions at that date, there is the ability to defer settlement for the next 12 months. And that has been clarified with quite detailed changes and quite extensive changes, I think, to paragraph 69D, of IAS 1, and also relevant to the discussion today, new paragraph 72A, in particular the second sentence in that paragraph. And this whole question of how to look at situations where there's debt covenants that will be tested after the reporting date was something that the board talked about at a number of board meetings when it was finalising the amendments. So it was something very thoroughly discussed by the board. And I think that we were assuming that people were more aware of the changes than perhaps they have turned out to be. And that's one of the reasons for bringing the paper, is to make sure people are aware of these changes. I think given that we now are aware that this is a bigger change than what people might have expected, it's particularly helpful that the board recently actually moved the effective date out by a year because of the COVID environment, because it will give more people time to digest and adjust for any changes they need to make. So I think the first thing to acknowledge is this is an area that the board looked at in a lot of detail, and it's an area where we knew we were bringing in some very specific changes to IAS 1. So it wasn't by accident. Now, I know that you can look at the examples that we've used in the paper and very easily come up with more complicated examples. In a way, because we didn't receive the submission, we had to work out, the staff needed to work out the best way to bring a paper that would be effective for the discussion. And we purposefully chose very simple examples. And that's not because we couldn't think of something smarter. It's not because people weren't asking us questions about more complex fact patterns. It's because we thought that there was a core disconnect between what we had meant and what people perhaps were thinking we had meant that were best highlighted using some really simple examples that really hone in on these new words in 69D and 72A. So you might well say, well, there's another 20 questions, and that might be true, but we thought it would be helpful at least to confirm the key aspects of the changes. And that's why these examples are very much of a very particular type and quite simplistic. Now, the last thing I'll say is that I think it's always the case that I try to get the committee, first of all, to comment on the analysis in the paper and the core question that the committee will be asked, which is, are the requirements adequate for people to know what to do? So please, in the first instance, if you could focus on that, rather than telling me whether or not it was a good idea that the board decided to make the amendments the way that they did. And then, as a second wave of comments, I'll be happy to take any observations you might want to share with us about the effects of the amendments. So with that very long tee up, which is partly to try to reduce the risk of offending anybody by telling them that they're off-piste, because I do want, first of all, to focus on what do the words say. I know people might not yet know how to apply these in practice, so we are asking you cold, using your experience as sophisticated readers of IFRS standards, what the words say when you read them, and to guide that and to use that to guide your analysis in this initial discussion. So with that big soapbox lecture, I think, John, you wanted to come in with a question?
Yeah, and thanks, Sue. I do think that this was an interesting paper. It did kind of forced me to think about the standard, even though we're not yet applying it within my organization. So I think to that end, it's been a helpful exercise for me. I wanted to confirm with the staff one point, just to make sure I understand how the staff is envisioning the standard being applied with a slightly different fact pattern, but trying to keep it simple nonetheless. So if we follow the same construct as case one, where at December 31st, we're assessing the working capital ratio, but let's assume that the working capital ratio is above 1.0 rather than below. But because of deteriorating conditions, the company is forecasting that in the next year, during one of the testing periods, whether it's at the end of March, end of June, or end of September, it doesn't matter, but within the next 12 months, they're forecasting their working capital to deteriorate to be below 1.0. How would the staff think about that assessment as of the 31st of December when preparing their 31st of December financial statements?
So a symmetry question.
Symmetry question, exactly right.
Who wants to respond to that? Because I think that is useful to set the scene. Liz, Ken?
I'm happy to hop in. And Ken, if you think that I've please write it, or if you have anything else to certainly do. But John, I think, as Sue said, I think your question is one of symmetry, and I think our analysis applies symmetrically. So I think in your example, it would, as long as the entity has met the condition at the reporting date, that liability would be classified as non-current, irrespective of what its forecasts are for the future, because future forecasts under these requirements don't matter, so they're not relevant to the assessment, irrespective of whether you think your forecast, you know, whether your forecasts are good, i.e., you know, the ratio is going to go up, or your forecasts are, you know, sort of quote unquote bad, and they're going to go down. So just to say that the analysis would be symmetrical.
Thank you. Yeah, that's how I was reading the requirements as well, but I appreciate confirmation that you were reading it in the same way.
Okay, thank you. So it's a test based on the numbers as at the reporting time. Okay, Donna.
Okay, so I think the first thing which kind of struck me is that indirectly the staff's paper is making it clear that the BC itself is not the standard. And as such, it provides insight into how the standard was written and what the intention behind the standard is, but it shouldn't be used as the justification for changing or interpreting the standard when the standard itself is explicit about the treatment. And I think that's actually quite a useful, so if we think about, you know, is there an unintended consequence to putting this paper out? My view is that actually what we're doing is we're making it a lot clearer by the FRAC members is that the BC really is there to support, not to override the standard itself. So I do appreciate where the staff is coming from, where they're saying, well, if you do analyze the BC, there could be an opportunity for interpreting it slightly differently. And I think that the way that the staff has written the paper, it becomes very clear that the BC is not the overrider. It's always the standard is explicit. And sometimes that's important because, you know, especially when it gets difficult, you know, there is a tendency to want to kind of, well, if there's an out, surely the standard says this, but it basically allows any kind of closure on arguments that are not supported by the actual main standard itself. So I think that's the one observation I'd like to agree with. And then, yes, and then I think it absolutely does clarify what the ISB, when they made the amendment to IS1, was really trying to get at. So I'm very happy with what the staff has done. Thanks.
Donna. Jens.
Thank you so much, Sue. So I'm happy to echo what Donna just pointed out on the last piece of her elaboration. I do think that is exactly what the standard tells you. So for each of the three cases, and I fully agree with the staff that it is helpful in our role as interpretation committee to address this issue based on informal feedback and inquiries received. So we don't need a submission to formal submission to address this issue. And the cases 1 and 2, I think these are straightforward from, and this is in line with the expectation I see in practice. I think the one that we can discuss further on is case 3. And I think especially on case 3, it is very helpful that we point out that this is the reading, and I fully agree with the reading and interpretation of what the standard tells you, that for case 3, this would be the solution that comes from reading of the amended guidance in IS1, that we point out as IFRS Interpretation Committee that this is our reading of the standard and that the reading that should be applied in practice. So therefore, I fully agree with both the intention of the agenda paper and bringing this agenda paper to the Interpretation Committee and the conclusion by the staff. Thank you.
Thank you, Jens. Who's next? Bob.
Thanks, Sue. First, I'd like to commend the staff for being very proactive. This is an area that has just recently gotten a lot of attention and people questioning what is the accounting in this area. And that might be because, if I recall correctly, this amendment was sort of at the end of the project and didn't really get fully exposed in the exposure draft. With that said, I think the examples are very helpful. I think the staff got it spot on. I think the basis for conclusions for me was very helpful in understanding what the model is, that you look at the test for the following 12 months, and it's like they all apply 365 days out of the year. They apply today, even if they're tested later. I'm gonna come back later on. I'm not sure I like the answer, especially on case 3, but that's not the question being asked. The question being asked is the examples and the step analysis right on with the standard, and I agree with that.
Thanks, Bob. Sophie.
Yes, hello. I also agree with the staff conclusion. I fully agree with the analysis. And in fact, I was not very expert on this matter, but then when I reviewed the requirements and the analysis, for me, I didn't see the interpretation issue. But based on what you said, you had a lot of discussion with some people, and it appears that it was good to have some examples and to show them how to apply the requirements. So I agree.
Thank you, Sophie. Bertrand.
I understand the staff analysis and agree with the conclusions. I'm not a huge practitioner of those issues, but at the same time, I was a bit curious of understanding why you would consider BC 48E as not being strictly relevant to better understand how to apply the requirements in the amendments, notably relating to case three. And the reason I'm asking the question is that in case three, you assess a ratio as at the end of the year and as at the end of the first quarter. And obviously, and it's a ratio, a working cap ratio, and obviously you may have variations in the working cap between year end and first quarter end. What we would do in terms of valuation for impairment testing, for instance, would be eventually to consider normalizing the working cap. I had the feeling, but once again, I'm not a huge practitioner of those issues. So I had the feeling that BC 48E was just there to mention the fact that we could effectively consider potentially an adjustment for normalizing the working cap at year end or at quarter end. I don't know, depending on the seasonality of the activities of the company, for instance. I was curious to better understand why this is not something that is implied by what BC48E is stating, even though I totally appreciate the fact that you do not consider, as mentioned in the staff paper, you do not consider just strictly the BC to analyze the core requirements of the standards, actually. But why those are not totally interacting together?
If it's okay with the staff, I might respond to that. And just to be efficient, Liz is nodding, so that's good. I actually printed the basis out this morning to reread it in preparation for the meeting, and sorry, I just saw Mary wants to come in. Mary, if you can follow me, that would be right. That would be helpful. And maybe just to give you a couple of observations. I think, firstly, John A's point is important. We can't override the requirements in the standard with the basis, so that I think that's, you know, that's one factor. But for me, when I read the basis paragraphs, I don't think there is personally an inconsistency, although I agree that perhaps it's subtle. So for me, the paragraph in the basis which sort of confirms the point that we're looking at is 48D. So it's reminding people that what the board was focusing on was you have to look at the compliance with specified conditions as at the reporting date, even if the compliance is later on. 48E followed from my recollection is that followed a very specific discussion we had at the board table, which is the more complicated situation where we're not talking so much about balance sheet ratios. So if you've got a balance sheet ratio, you can, you know, the numbers are the numbers, and those are sort of the examples that are in the paper. And even though we all know that there could be differences during the year, you do have numbers that are, you know, sort of closing balances that can be used at the date. 48E reflected a more nuanced discussion that the board had, which was about, as it says, cumulative financial performance measures. So if you had, for example, make up a stupid covenant, which probably doesn't exist, but let's say I had a covenant which said that I could, my lending was contingent on my revenue being above £100 million, and I was only one quarter through the year, it would be silly to say, well, I've only earned £30 million, therefore I fail. And so that was more the, it was the cumulative performance scenarios, which was the what 48E was focused on, not so much the balance sheet totals. But that's quite subtle. But that's why I don't think there actually is, even if I could use the basis to override the front, I think it's addressing a slightly different point. Mary, did you want to come in?
No, I was just going to expose myself as the board member who created the problem in the first place, because I had suggested when the board was discussing this that we specify how you deal with the cumulative ratio. And so the staff brought a paper back to the following meeting at which they recommended, and we agreed, including me, that we wouldn't specify whether you did your example, Sue, just now was you're only one quarter of the way through the, you know, through the compliance period. We wouldn't specify whether you annualized one quarter or did 9 months actual plus one quarter or other means you could do. We just we're going to flag that you shouldn't do you shouldn't be doing the cumulative test in a way that compared apples and oranges rather than apples and apples. So just was giving a bit more background on that paragraph BC48E.
So that's consistent with my recollection. It was on this very specific point where you had a sort of metric that was more of a P&L metric rather than a balance sheet sort of metric, to put it simply.
Yeah, so that's more dealing with the flows actually, which makes it consistent with my remark relating to impairment testing, where effectively you consider eventually normalizing a working cap within the cash flows, actually a working cap adjustment within the cash flow to normalize the working capital, but within the cash flow actually. So makes sense.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Sue, and hello, everyone. Very interesting discussion about the BC. I actually find that paragraph, together with paragraph 36 in the staff paper, and this distinction between cumulative financial performance and financial position, quite helpful, actually, and this is a good discussion. I mean, overall, I think the staff paper and the cases are incredibly helpful. They've really helped me understand what the test really is, which is that I stand there at the balance sheet date, I identify any covenant that's going to be tested in the next 12 months that depends on a test of financial position, and I do that test based on my financial position at the year end, and I do not have a debate about the things I might do in the future to help me meet, or things that might happen in the future that would stop me meeting covenants during the course of the next 12 months. I don't think about whether the covenant is designed to accommodate seasonality. I don't think about whether the covenant is designed to accommodate a change in the business. I just do what I just described. And I know we might talk later about where that takes you, but I think that it comes through very clearly in the staff paper, and I definitely agree with the conclusions to the cases.
Thanks, Brian. Young Sue?
Yeah, I also want to say, you know, I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. And I also want to say that the examples are very helpful. It helps me to understand the amendment. And, you know, if we strictly follow the amendment, we cannot but to get to the same conclusion as the staff does. And also, I think that this amendment can reduce diversity in practice because we do not allow any subjective judgment. So, you know, the I agree with the amendment. The agenda decision itself, I have no objections onto that. But later, I want to say something about the amendment. I have something to say, something about the amendment, not about the agenda decision. So I should say I agree with the agenda decisions.
Okay. Thanks, Young Sue. Carsten. Carsten?
I'm sorry, so?
Yes.
Hello? I was double muted. I'm sorry. I was just going to echo what others have said very briefly. I think this paper has been very helpful to explain the requirements in IS1. Focusing on the question that you have asked, I think the examples make it quite clear that, this is what IS1 revised requires. So I do agree with the staff analysis in terms of what the requirements in revised IS1 are.
Thanks, Carsten. Guy.
Okay, Sue. I guess I have a few more detailed comments that I wanted to raise here. I do very much see the analysis of 69D and 72A as applied to the working capital test cases as highlighted in the paper. And I very much see the outcome of the application of the amendments to those in the way the staff paper lays it out. That seems to flow directly from the words in 69D and 72A. However, what confuses me here is the discussion in BC 48E with regard to financial performance covenants and a suggestion in BC 48E that the thought process there is slightly different in terms of a mismatch in the period to date and the cumulative period in the covenant test, and the notion that some sort of adjustment is warranted there, I continue to be quite confused as to the intersection of BC 48E on financial performance type covenants and how that links with the requirements in 69D and 72A. And I can think of a number of examples where I see very little distinction between a financial position test versus a financial performance test. Financial position is often the result of financial performance, and the discussion in BC 48E continues to confuse me in terms of the application of the principle in 69D and 72A. If I'm asked though to just comment on the three scenarios that are analyzed in the paper, the result, as expressed in the paper, seems to be the natural reading of 69D and 72A and its application to those three scenarios. But I'm not sure I personally fully appreciate the scope of this principle and how it applies across a range of different scenarios. But if I look at those three scenarios in isolation, I see and would tend to agree that the way it's been analyzed is the right reading of the standard. But I continue to think there's a lot of other scenarios that require further analysis to make sure we're fully comprehending the scope and implications of the principle expressed in 69D and 72A.
Mary, do you want to come in?
Yes, hence the hand waving. Guy, I think one of the things you're reminding me is that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And it was my good intention to try and just provide a bit more detail or specificity when I raised the question at the board about what you do if the covenant test period is off from your reporting date, both for year end, and for interims. Given the question you asked about BC 48E, it makes me regret that we chose to use the word adjustment in 46E, because it's really not talking about adjusting so much as using a sensible period, and the fact that the board decided not to specify how you did that, just so that if you had a 12-month test, that it was, you know, 12, Sue's example of a certain amount of revenue in a 12-month period, that, you know, you tested it using a 12-month number and we weren't going to tell you how to calculate it. I don't know if it would be helpful. I mean, we're talking about a basis paragraph, and I think, as you said, if you just focus on the words in the standard itself, I think it's pretty clear answers for these, for the three examples, the three fact patterns. But, you know, I don't think there's anything we can do about the wording of BC 48E at this point in time. But I think it becomes a lot clearer if you read the staff paper that was the basis for the underlying discussion when the board said, yeah, we're not going to bother specifying how to do the apples to apples calculations if you've got the timing mismatch. But it was not about adjusting, you know, in terms of expectations.
Which I think is helpful, because I think one of the main points of the whole amendment was, you know, it's a bit of a blunt tool, I'll give you that. But what it does do is it means you just use the numbers that are, you know, in your financial statements. You're not going around estimating what you're going to think is going to happen and all of these sorts of things. You're using the numbers that exist. And I think that that's consistent with your comment that we didn't mean adjusting. Lisa?
Yes, thanks, Sue. On my first read of the amendments to IS1, I have to say that I could understand where there was maybe different interpretations in how preparers would look at this, because I wasn't exactly sure on paragraph 72A what was meant here, because it is so different to what's applied today in practice. But the staff paper, you know, as always, did an excellent job laying out how to analyze this and looking at it. So I would agree in applying that in the words in the standard and the requirements to the fact pattern. I would agree with the staff paper. I do have some of the same concerns that, you know, Bertrand and Guy had raised on BC 48E, and really the differences in, you know, how you would look at that. You know, what's the difference between the cumulative and a financial performance on an income statement item versus as some of the examples that were already raised around different ratios or working capital. But I hear some of the comments that are being made. But I guess, yeah, I agree with the staff paper, but I probably would have more questions about just the actual amendments themselves. But we'll leave that for your next question.
Jim?
I think this paper is written well and it serves the purpose well, as Sue mentioned earlier, and to explain the amendments and to tell people what to think and how to interpret the words. And I also think the three cases are designed very well to show what to be relevant and what is not. And this paper has nothing wrong, or I like this the logic and the conclusion. But as others mentioned, whether we like these consequences of these amendments is another issue. So just answering Sue's first question, I agree with this paper and the conclusion. And I do have some concerns about the amendments and its consequences. That's our next question, I believe. So I will stop right here. The paper is fine and it follows the amendments strictly, and the cases are designed very well. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Goro.
Okay, thank you. I also agree with the staff's analysis and conclusion, and even from financial statement user's point of view, this analysis is very clear and the logic is easy to understand. It is important for us, the financial statement users, that classification of the debt with covenants to be consistent. I think that this agenda decision they encourage the consistent application among the preparers. And having said that, as a former advisory council member, I have a little concern about the due process. As Sue said, that the everybody appears to support to issue the agenda decision without submission. But the my concern is that the due process handbook says that we would publish the agenda decision to explain why not to add that the agenda to the the standards setting project when the submission was made, so that before this agenda decision, had we ever had the agenda decision to be published to handle the issue like this without submission? And also, fortunately, that we have plenty of time to that this amendment of IS-1 to be effective. Can we encourage that the stakeholders to submit that the submission to us on this issue? If possible, I think that would be more desirable for us to handle this more in a more transparent way. Thank you.
I can comment on the couple of points that you've raised there. Firstly, we've got a public board paper and a public discussion. It'll go out for public comment, so I don't think that we can too concerned about transparency. It's a bright light, and in a sense, by bringing it so early, we're really alerting people much more than would otherwise be the case. The other question you asked, I think, was, do we have to have a submission to bring a question to the committee? Mm-hmm. Have we got any precedent? We have brought questions in the past before. We had a question a few years ago that I remember specifically on negative interest rates that we brought ourselves, because ultimately our objective is to support consistent application. And if we have situations where we're aware of risks of inconsistent application or actual inconsistent application, it's important that we do what we can to use the tools to deal with that, and can't sort of sit and wait and hope somebody asks a question, because nobody might want to ask a question. And so I think it's important that we can be proactive, but then people have the opportunity to comment so that there's a thorough process for people to have input. So I think it's fine from a due process perspective.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that your view and on how we should deal with this is very clear, and anyway, I observed that most of other members support that to issue the agenda decision to help that consistent application without submission. I do not, disagree with to publish the agenda decision. Thank you.
Thanks, Cara. Michael.
Thanks, Sue. I just had one observation. So I don't disagree either that with the staff's analysis that's a reading of the standard, and that seemed very sensible to me. I guess just to Mary's apples with apples point, that's where I could see that I could read it slightly differently, and I think it was those words in my computer has not frozen in IS-1 that said even if they're testing at a later date. So I kind of read that as being, well, even if the test is at a later date, but based on year-end information, that doesn't mean that you ignore that later test, whereas testing at a later date based on later information, I could see as being something that is not within the scope of what the standard is saying. So, as I say, I could see it could be read differently, but I don't disagree with the analysis that is certainly a valid reading and clearly what was intended.
Okay, thanks, Michael. I think before I ask you to vote on whether or not you agree with the staff's recommendation not to add a standard setting project to the work plan, I'll give people an opportunity to comment on whether they have any thing they think should be shared with the board in terms of this issue. Before we do that, if it's okay, I might make a comment from my own perspective as a board member and then see if any of the other board members want to comment in terms of observations, and then I'll open it up for... Gore, would you mind muting? I'll open it up for other people to provide some comments, because I think we need to be careful not to get into the situation where we have issues flip-flopping between the Interpretations Committee and the board, either from an agenda decision perspective or a standard setting perspective, and if we can avoid it. And it's one of the reasons why we have board member observers and me chairing the committee, is to give the committee some more data points, if you like, about what board responses might be to particular things. And I think that if we've done some fairly recent standard setting and we've sort of got current thoughts about it, it's probably useful to know the thoughts of our thoughts, for you to be aware of that, because it gives you at least, it's not the whole board obviously, but a sense of thinking at the board table on something that we looked at pretty recently. And when I look at the examples and I look at the outcomes, I wasn't surprised with the outcomes, nor did I think the outcomes were inappropriate. And I think important for me is that one of the things we wanted to make clear when we made these amendments in IAS1 was that what the old words unconditional at the end of the period was supposed to mean, as far as the board was concerned, was, you know, based on the situation as at the reporting date, were you compliant or not in the case of these covenant situations? And by being clear that we meant that that be tested using sort of numbers as at the reporting date, what we were avoiding was a situation where people had to sort of look forward and make expectations of whether they thought covenant tests would be met in the next 12 months, because then we would need to put in some parameters, I think, for how would you, what was the basis for the assessment? More likely than not, what you expect, probability weighted, how would you make the assessment of the future if you're using something other than the numbers as at the reporting date? So for me, it was quite a conscious decision on the part of the board. And it was, from recollection, in response to people saying, we need clarity of what the amendments mean for covenant tests, that we went the extra mile and put some extra guidance in there. But it was to try and give this sort of certainty around how to do these assessments when you do have these tests during the next 12 months, which may then affect your ability to defer settlement of a liability. And I think that was the board's intention. So I don't think that there's anything in the standard that I can see written here that, on reflection, I think, geez, that's what not what I meant to sign off on. So that's sort of my perspective. I don't know, do any of the other board members want to come in? Anne, I see you wanted to say something.
Yes, thanks, Sue. Yes, I just wanted to share with the committee that we did have detailed discussions at the board, and we felt that by making these changes to IAS1, it would clarify a situation that was currently unclear, situation that did have diversity in practice at the moment. And so I think board members really did consider those words and the meaning of those words when we focused in on as at the year end and the implications that that would have. So I do think it was a conscious decision putting those words there and endeavouring to bring clarity. And so consequently, these three cases that the staff have put in the paper for today do illustrate the application of that sharper focus on as at year end. Thanks, Sue.
Thanks, Anne. Rika, did you want to come in?
Thank you, Sue. I think I echo other board members said, but I think this amendment clarify was to enable the entity to classify the liability based on the like as at the reporting date without relying on management intention and expectation of the future outcome in volatility and uncertainty. So this point of amendment apparently helped the practice to reduce diversity made when applying IS1. But I understand, because I was in the practice So on the other hand, depending on the existing practice, the classification, this amendment might affect some practical application. And I understand some people raise questions about how to apply our language. But so because of that, I really think that today's discussion here is really important, and it will be really helpful for a consistent application of the new amendment. So thank you very much for today's discussion.
Thanks, Rika. Okay, so with that, I don't see any other board members twitching. Things popping up on my screen, I can't see people. Right, so I'll hand it back now to the committee for any other observations that you want to make. And I think, Bob, you were first in the queue for this.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Sue. This was an area before the amendment, this was an area that was quite contentious, had lots of questions coming in on what it, when something is current versus not current. And so I think the amendment was helpful, particularly in where we've seen in cases one and two. I think case three is the one that'll be really interesting when we get comment letters and things for the board to think about. As I understand the model, it's complying with specific conditions applies not just at one point in time, but is considered to be a continuous test, something you have to comply with continuously, not just when it says you've got to do the actual arithmetic to do the test. Now, in case three, you might have a case where it was intended by the parties that they meet 1.0 at a certain date and they meet 1.1 at a future date. And the model doesn't really reflect that because it says, hey, it's a continuous test throughout the year, when the parties intended that, no, the test really wasn't continuous throughout the year. The test was meant to be different at some point in the future. So we'll see what we get with comments when we issue the agenda decision. But I think that's just something, you know, we might hear back.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Bertrand.
Thank you, Sue. What I like in the model, to paraphrase Bob, entailed by the within the amendments, is that effectively when you think notably of a financial position test, everything which happens after the closing date is a subsequent event, and let's put it that way, is a non-adjusting event. So you do not take it into consideration in your closing balance sheet, for instance. And I mean, it makes total sense to me and to the way we apply things in the company I'm working for. At the same time, there was something that struck me a bit, and notably it's within the application of case two, and the application of the model there negates the will of the parties within the contract. So if the borrower and the lender have agreed upon the fact that the ratio should be measured end of 31st March of the year, effectively, maybe the ratio is not met at the preceding year-end closing date, but it doesn't mean that it won't be the case at the 31st March of the next year. And where I was a bit struck by the conclusion there and by the outcome of the application of the amendments is that it just negates the will of the parties. Maybe they have, for a very good reason, decided on both sides on an arm's-length basis that effectively they should compute the ratio at the end of 31st March of the following year, just because of seasonality of activities, because of what I mentioned earlier on the fact that 31st March the working cap should be a bit more normalized than the end of the year for any very good reasons, and then the application of the requirements within the amendments negates just what the parties have decided together. So I was a bit struck by that. So positive aspects, because once when you close your account, you consider what you have effectively signed at the closing date, and not what might be eventually signed between the closing date and the release dates of the accounts, which is always a nightmare to follow for a preparer. At the same time, I was quite surprised by the outcome, notably relating to case two on the fact that it could effectively tend to negate the conditions discussed between the parties within the contract. I don't know why that. Is there a reason for this? Or
I think it's again, the approach that's been chosen is very, it's a simple approach. I'm not going to pretend it's a, you know, a mathematics dream, if you like. It's just a simple approach. And I think following that simple logic, as at the reporting date, the best, the sort of most solid information you've got to assess whether or not you're going to be able to meet that new test in a few months' time, which is the one I think you're focusing on, is to use the numbers as at the reporting date, and based on those numbers, there's a risk you're not going to meet it. So I think that's the logic. You know, there's different ways you could have done it, but I think that was the logic. It's just the simple way to do it. Guy?
Which I totally understand. I mean, what I'm not saying that we should normalize the computation of the ratio at your ends to correct whatever seasonality impacts or whatever. I'm not saying that, and I'm not suggesting that, because effectively, in practice, it's impossible to document properly and it's always subject to interpretations or whatever. So I'm not suggesting that at all. But I'm just saying that the ratio at your end in this instance is neither met nor not met. I mean, there's nothing we cannot say. And if you another way to say it is, if you reclassify your liability as current, you will have to put a disclosure saying, but by the way, the proper computation will be end of March, and but in the let's assume in the during the five past years, the ratio had never been met end of the year, but it has always been met or it had always been met at the end of the first quarter. So you would have to put a disclosure in this regard, just to give an additional insight to the MEC classification within the balance sheet. And you could well then just do nothing and provide so maintain the debt as non-current, and then just put a note saying, but we'll have to compute. This is provisional because the computation of the ratio would be end of first quarter of the next year. So and I don't see where there is bad information in the two aspects, as long as you describe the situation, the exact situation at your end.
I think the explanation, you know, the note explanation would make sense in the fact pattern you have described to give a full picture to users of the financial statements. But unless we do it the way that's in the standard, we'd need to find a mechanism to... We're trying to work out whether or not within the next 12 months you're going to have to repay or have a risk of having to repay. And unless you do something to test the new ratio... You can't do it, so it's the way we chose. But, Guy, would you like to come in?
Thanks, Sue. I just wanted to reiterate the point I was alluding to earlier. In that, I think issuing this tentative agenda decision is going to lead to numerous follow-on questions that I think we're going to be compelled to respond to in some way, and I think those questions will stem from the distinction between a financial position test and a financial performance test, and the words in BC 48E and having difficulty understanding how the approach to a financial performance test as expressed in BC 48E is consistent with the approach we're enumerating for a financial position test. And if I just use a very simplistic example that aligns, I think, with case three in the paper. In case three in the paper, we have a financial position test that is measured at December, and then it's measured again at June, but the threshold is higher at June. We meet the threshold at December, but we're not at December as high as the test will require at June, and we've determined that in that case, we don't have the right to defer settlement, and the debt would be current. If I contrast that with, let's say, a 12-month EBITDA test that is rolling, so I have a 12-month December EBITDA threshold, and I've met that 12-month threshold at December, but I have a 12-month EBITDA rolling threshold at June that is higher, and my 12-month EBITDA at December has not yet met that 12-month higher threshold at June. BC48E seems to imply that there is some mechanism there to address that with and being able to conclude that I have the right to defer settlement in that case. But that does not seem, in my mind, to be consistent with the financial position test that we're illustrating in case three in the paper. And so I think there are going to be a number of follow-on questions in terms of how to apply these amendments to financial performance type tests such as the one I was just describing. And I think we're probably going to be compelled to respond to that because my suspicion is that's going to a number of those questions are going to come through in comment letters.
I don't disagree with you, Guy. I think that's pretty likely. But the reason why we brought these three simple cases, we don't even have consistency of understanding in these really, really simple fact patterns at the moment. And that and so we want to at least try and address that, because otherwise I'm not sure quite what we've achieved with these amendments. Marie?
Yeah, thank you. We think it's really useful to have this paper, and we do agree that it might increase consistency and consistent application. So we welcome this discussion, and think it's helpful. And we do agree that today it's maybe not understood the same way on this different fact pattern. However, we think that it might be better to do standard setting and not an agenda decision for different reasons. The first one is that, as you said, this amendment only apply in 2023, so I think there is time to amend the standard and to add maybe that as example or something in the standard itself, where we think it might be more helpful and more useful for people just to see them and to understand. And as it was mentioned before, there are also some elements which are maybe not so clear. There is a question made by Michael on the way to understand exactly the paragraph and this tension with BC. So we think it would be more useful. And the last comment we have is we do agree that in some cases, and namely in case three, we question sort of the relevance of the classification, because as was already explained, I think by Bob and by Guy, you might raise cases where you will classify as of December as current because you do not meet the threshold you should meet in June, but in June because of seasonality or something, you will meet it. So it means that sort of each year you will classify and declassify from current to non-current, and maybe it would have been more useful to deal it with disclosures.
Thanks, Marie. Jens.
Thank you so much. Sorry, there's an echo. I do think I first want to specify my answer to the question, and the question is, do I agree with the recommendation to not add standard setting? And without echoing what the colleagues have said already, I agree with a lot of these comments. I do think in this current status, we are at current stage, I would highly recommend not to add standard setting right now, because I think it's to foster consistent application, we should bring out the tentative agenda decision. And my personal view is, my expectation is that we will get a lot of feedback on the tentative agenda decision, especially around the interpretation of on the facts for case 3, where I do think this will raise discussion in practice. And now for this time, as of today, I would say we should not add or not need to decide on standard setting as of today, but rather could defer this decision when we have feedback from the comment letters, and then it's up to the board to decide whether they want to pick up the feedback in the comment letters. And albeit I do think there will be a lot of comment letters, especially addressing case 3, but it could be the other way around, that practice is fine with this, or even that the accounting requirements change existing practice. And even for these entities that have these seasonal clauses in their covenant tests, and that they change these clauses due to the, as you mentioned, simplified accounting solution. So my reply to question 2 would be, at this point in time, I would say no standard setting. We can and should wait based on the due process we have for these, for the new due process that we do have, the 90 days of feedback that we can receive. And after receiving the feedback, we can re-decide whether or not there should be standard setting, and then it's up to the board. But my reply today would be no. I agree with the committee that no standard setting should be brought forward as of today.
Thanks, Jens. Brian.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I thought your comments, Sue, were really helpful. I find the increased clarity of the test very useful, and I find the rigorously objective nature of it absolutely brilliant from a kind of auditor perspective. I mean, I guess the issue is that with cases 2 and 3, once people get to grips with it, they come back and say, is that really the right outcome? Do I really have to classify as current based on a covenant test that was never intended to be conducted as at today's date? And because it's not a test that's in the documentation as at today's date, I can't seek a waiver or anything like that. And for me, that's kind of the trade-off here. Obviously, as you said, there hasn't been a submission. It's really hard to do outreach on something that isn't yet effective. So similar to what Jens was saying, I think it would be really good to actually go ahead, not to the board, but to go ahead with the tentative agenda decision, draw people's attention to this, see what's the nature and the extent of the feedback that comes in, and reflect then.
Thanks, Brian. Carsten.
Yeah, thanks. So first of all, I think, you know, the clarifications around the discussions that took place at the board were really helpful for me. I understand the reasoning much better now. And I do think it's certainly helpful to deal with this on a proactive basis, right? And not wait until, you know, this really comes up via submission, or wait until 2023. Maybe just to anticipate what I would expect to come up in the comment letters, you know, as some others have also mentioned. You know, kind of feedback that I would expect to be getting on the comment letters on a tentative agenda decision. So I think the first point is, you know, as I guess I was in a quite similar place as Bob. You know, he already pointed out a couple of things, including and also you yourself, Sue, I think, that pointed out that this is perhaps a bigger change than people were expecting when commenting on the initial exposure draft. And I think the second point I would make is around, you know, the case 3 that several others have mentioned already, especially the aspect of, you know, does this really make sense when you're in a cyclical or seasonal business? I think that's what I would probably expect to hear back from stakeholders, but I certainly understand and appreciate the logic behind it. I understand that much better now, you know, just to keep it simple, and all the issues around forecasting what do you do with probabilities and so on, right? But that's certainly what I would expect to hear. And I'm expecting especially this aspect about a cyclical or seasonal business to come up very much in the comments that we will be getting. Thank you.
Thanks, Carsten. Young Soo.
All right. I have two comments. The first one is actually the comment on your question on how to make the assessment of the future. And I think we can make an assessment of the future what they sound some fact basis. For example, we can use the past experience, or we can use the characteristics of the industry or the company, or we can use the reasonable prediction about the future. I mean that in accounting, we are using many sound prediction and estimation, and without that, accounting does not exist. But in this amendment, we don't allow any estimation at all, regardless of whether that estimation is bad or good. So that is what I'm not really comfortable with the amendment. So for example, many people says about the cyclical or the seasonal business. And if any companies in the seasonal business and show their past records like that, you know, they were not able to meet the conditions at the reporting date, but they were able to meet the conditions at the testing date so that they were successfully, you know, renew the liability for another year. And that was the record the company showed for the many years in the past. And if we see that the future economy is almost the same as the past, then we can make a reasonable and sound estimation about the future. I mean that company, even though the company does not meet the debt covenant conditions at the reporting date, maybe the company could be reasonably estimated to meet the conditions at the testing date. But you know, the amendment we disregard all those sound estimations. So that is what I think is really uncomfortable with me. And one more thing I want to say is that, you know, the amendment could make the companies to do what they do not have to do. So as in the example that I showed, that I explained, the company expects that they can meet the terms or conditions of the debt covenant at the testing date. Then they don't have to do anything at all. But this amendment makes the company to do something at the reporting date to meet the conditions of the debt covenant. Maybe the company has to issue some stocks or raise capitals only because of accounting, not because they want to renew the liability for another year. So that kinds of things are the observations I see when I read the agenda paper and the amendment. So I couldn't say I'm really comfortable with the amendment. So that's about it.
Okay, thank you. Sophie?
I agree with these comments, I would say. I fully understand the objective of the board, and I think that a simple approach is always good to when it is relevant. But here, I would be very much more comfortable if it was based on expectation or a highly probable criterion. Not intention, just expectation based on a highly probable criterion. And it exists, for instance, with IFRS 5. It is also a question of presentation. When it is highly probable that there will be a disposal of an entity or some assets, we use the held for sale classification. Why not here doing judgment on these based on a highly probable criterion? I think that it would avoid misleading information in the financial statements and maybe volatility in the way in the presentation of the balance sheet.
Jing Chao.
Thank you, Sue. I feel the discussion really useful, and also some of the members mentioned the seasonal business, cycle business, and whether preparers prepare their financial statement should consider the future or expected business or expected information. It actually really reminded me similar issue actually occurred when companies prepare their interim financial reporting. So that is, there's clear requirement included in IAS 34. So what's the basic principle there? All the recognition, measurement, and disclosure actually based on year-to-date basis. So that means they will not consider the future, you know, expected those information, something like that. Even some business are seasonal business, and they will still consider based on the year-to-date basis, consider the information available at the reporting date. So in terms of this, I think it's also consistent with the current paragraph, the amendments we made, paragraph 69D, which we are looking at is exactly, we are looking at the right, which exists at the reporting date, not the future. So I think this kind of principle is consistent with each other. So in this, I personally, I think the principle, the requirement is clear, but in order to enhance or achieve the consistent application, I think it's a good way to go forward with the agenda decision.
Thank you, Zhengqiu. John.
Yeah, so I just to echo some of the comments that have been made already, I think that the analysis by the staff and that the tentative agenda decision would accurately reflect what is written in the standard. I also agree that particularly when we look at case three, you can envision a number of scenarios that would be very normal, particularly within seasonal businesses, that could be problematic. And I would hope that that would maybe come out through the comment letter process and then be something that the board could consider if that was the intended consequence or not. Notwithstanding that the words on the page, if I look specifically at 69D, I think would tell us to apply the standard as summarized in the staff paper. So I think it would be good to go ahead and to move forward with the tentative agenda decision in order to solicit that feedback and then ultimately have the board potentially consider if that was the intended consequence of the words on the page.
Okay, thanks, John. Lisa.
Thanks, Sue. I understand the board's position of wanting to ensure that preparers have the unconditional right to not have to repay the debt within the 12 months. But I guess my question I have would be is that, because this goes to example three in the tentative decision, is did the board consider just making the statement that if you have any debt covenants that have to be tested or complied with within a 12-month period, then you would not meet the criteria and should actually report that as non-current. Because to me, you don't have the unconditional right to say at that reporting period, even if you met the covenant at the reporting date, if when you go to test it in 3 months, you don't meet it, that proves that you didn't have the unconditional right at the reporting period to not have to repay the debt in 12 months. And I guess the overall concern I have here is more with the inconsistency in the amendment to the standard. It just seems as if, and I don't want to continue to say the same thing others have said, but it goes into that if you can't take into the probability and being able to demonstrate at that reporting date that you have, although maybe you haven't met the covenant at that point, but you have always, it's been the same situation every year because of maybe your business cycle that you've always met it at a future date. If you can't take that into account, then it seems a little bit harsh to not then say, well, how can I automatically, or why should I be allowed, I should maybe say, why should I be allowed to automatically assume that just because I met a covenant at the reporting date, I'm going to meet it in the next 3 to 6 months? So I guess if I loop back, you know, was that something that the board considered of whether or not just to make it a blanket requirement that if you, you know, have covenants in the 12 months, you can't meet that requirement?
What about that?
Pardon? I know. And I'm not that anyone would like that answer, but I just, you know, I guess I'm just thinking about kind of like the consistency there.
Just thought I actually had a conversation with Liz yesterday. If we were using financial instrument thinking, 32 thinking, the fact that there were covenants at all mean you wouldn't have certainty that you wouldn't have to repay in the next 12 months because there's always a chance you could breach. So I think the board that hasn't been that extreme. So they have tried to bring in an element of estimation. But as I've said before, I think that this was designed to be a very simple, really objective and easy way to try and estimate in some form. You know, we're not saying we've taken off the table that it's current necessarily because there's a chance that you might breach. Because you're right, there is, of course, always a chance that what you've got at the year end is not representative of what's going to happen, going back to John's example that he asked right at the start. So the board's saying, OK, we want to test the covenant as at the reporting date, so assess the rights as at the reporting date. And the objective, simple way we've chosen to do it is using the numbers as at the reporting date. So there is an element of estimation. You're right, we could be more extreme. It's the way of doing it. And, you know, we could, of course, have done it a different way. I think we need to be a little bit careful that the committee doesn't see its role as saying to the board, we don't like your amendments, because we're meant to be about consistent application and then observations about effects. And I think we're risking tipping a little bit into introducing a notion of being able to overrule what the board's done because you may not like it. And I think we need to be a little bit conscious of not pushing too far, if I can just sort of nudge that into the conversation.
Yeah. And that's definitely not wouldn't be the intention. It's just really highlighting some of the different implications. And I agree with you. I think that what's written in the standard is, as far as you say, it's very clear. When you understand how to apply it, it's very clear how you do the test. It's just maybe the unintended consequences of that test. And is that going to represent certain maybe entities appropriately? Because maybe they will always have their long-term debt that they pay in the long term always shown is current.
But just to be clear, it's not unintended based on the way that the board decided to do the test. Okay. Yeah? The okay. board decided that wanted to do the test based on the numbers as at the reporting date as the most objective and simple basis to test. Do you really have the right, based on the best of the information I've got as at the reporting date, to have more than 12 months to repay? And so that's not unintended in that sense, which is why we had so many discussions on it. Bertrand, I think you were next.
Yeah, just wanted to add a further comment more in terms of process, because maybe not as much as what Goro expressed initially, but I was not initially that comfortable with the idea of issuing an agenda, a tentative agenda decision on an amendment or a standard that has not yet come into force. At the same time, I'm not saying that now I'm totally comfortable with that, but I'm less uncomfortable maybe to do so. Thanks to the discussion today, which was a very useful discussion in that instance. And then I just wanted to highlight the fact that it would have been typically a subject whereby the possibility for the board to issue an agenda decision would have been great. So you don't have this tool. So let's be pragmatic. You don't have this tool. I rather prefer an agenda decision rather than educational material. Effectively, it will be a good way to test with the feedbacks received whether there are further comments that maybe an insight for the effective application of the amendments or for the amendments themselves. So it would be a way also to test live everything. But at the same time, I would like maybe that's two things. The first one would be to explain in the introductory paragraph of the agenda of the tentative agenda decision where the question comes from, because it's not stated right now, and I think it would be useful for everybody really to understand why we would issue a tentative agenda decision if we decide to issue such an that decision as a committee. And the second thing would be I'm not sure it's now, maybe it would be next time when we analyze the comments, but in a way to alert the board as to really have a careful attention to the feedbacks received if we were to decide the issuance of a tentative agenda decision now, then we will receive feedback certainly, and then in a way to have also, I don't know, it's possible in terms of process, but getting also the feedback from the board on those feedbacks received by the committee if we were to decide an tentative agenda decision.
Thank you, Bertrand. Donna?
Sorry, so but I just want to kind of throw my 5 cents worth in here from a banker's perspective on loan covenants. And I was actually having a chat to a couple of our deal makers and our credit team at FirstRand with regards to this. And it's what's really interesting about a covenant is a covenant is actually enforceable. In theory, it's enforced all the way through the year. The fact that the bank selects a specific date to test the covenant is normally just for pragmatic purposes. So in other words, it's part of the annual review process, etc. However, a bank has the right to go in and test those loan covenants at any point during the year, for example. And if you are in breach, you're in breach of contract, and therefore the contract would then be basically payable on demand. So I'm very supportive of the view that the ISP has taken. And yes, it may seem it is a simplistic approach, but it's actually not. It's actually based in real legal, the legality of the right that the bank has to actually knock on your door and say, I want to test your covenants. Yes, I know the agreement doesn't say I don't have to test until the 31st of March, for example. And if you're breaching, we need to have a chat. Now, as a banker, for example, I would want to know whether my customer, who may have a big multi-bank, whether they in actual fact have any of these covenants that are breached at year end, because that will then bring into clear focus the stress that may be existing in the business, as well as whether in actual fact the loan covenants work. So if it's a seasonal business, then the reality is that the ISP is basically just saying that if you're a seasonal business, then you need to write your contracts with your bankers better to say is that they are aware of that seasonality. They're aware that there will be periods that will be breached, and that during those periods, there will be a waiver of it. Not a reservation, it's very important. The waiver basically says we will forgive what you've got at the moment because it's seasonal. If you reserve, basically it just says we haven't waived, but we have the right to knock on your door and call for the money. And it's really important. So the consequence of the amendment actually makes the business have to be a little bit more careful and not lazy in discussions with their bankers about how they want their loan covenants to be actually detailed in their legal agreements. And if they do need you, they'll need to go back to their bankers and say, we have a real problem here because the standard says we have to do this. But what's the intention? Is the intention that you are allowed to come and knock on my door at any time and test for covenants? And if I have failed covenants, that I am actually required to then pay on demand. So I actually think that the amendment allows and encourages businesses to be more mindful about how they negotiate their loan covenants with their bankers. Thanks.
Thanks, Donna. And that's something that certainly came up in the recent decision to defer the effective date. Guy, you want to come back in?
Yeah, thanks, Sue. I just wanted to pick up on one thing you said. I've tried to be careful throughout this discussion not to sort of second guess what the board has done with the amendments. But my comments are more directed on your point about, are they capable of consistent application? And that is my main concern throughout this discussion. I think in the financial position type scenarios we've enumerated, I think that's simple and clear, but there are numerous other questions that flow from that we need more clarity on to ensure consistent that this will be capable of consistent application going forward. In particular, the financial performance tests that we've discussed throughout this discussion, and one other thing that comes to mind that has not been mentioned is how do we apply these concepts to non-financial covenants? Is another aspect here that I think may come through in some of the comment letters. So I think we're just scratching the tip of the iceberg here in responding to questions that will need to be responded to in order to enable consistent application of the principles in 69D and 72A.
Okay, thank you. Has everybody who wants to speak spoken? Yep, okay. Now we move to the easy bit, the voting. So I think we need to vote on question two, which is, does the committee agree with our recommendation not to add a standard setting project to the work plan? Can I get a show of hands, please? Katrina, are you counting or am I counting?
Everyone that I can see has their hand up. Is that correct? Is there any member who's not right. Who's voting against?
Yes, and Brian also. He's got his hand up by telephone.
Okay, great. So that should be 13 then.
Thank you. I think when we report back to the board, Katrina, we will need to flag that this was quite a detailed discussion, which is going to be important, especially important now, given that, ultimately, if this were to get to a finalised agenda decision one day in the future, the board will be involved in that now. So we want to give them a heads up as early on as we can these days anyhow. So we'll do that. Now, do people have any... Does anybody have any comments on the wording in the tentative agenda decision?
I may just initially comment on adding to the introductory paragraph explaining why we issue an agenda decision. Where does this come from, actually?
I think what might be useful to put there is usually we talk about a submission being submitted. Perhaps we could say that this has come about because we're aware of questions around the application of these new amendments and put a little bit of a lead in. If that's what you mean, I think we could look at doing that, unless Katrina's
yes,
going to get me.
That is right.
Sure. Just like a general sort of comment. That it's arisen from questions that we've been hearing. Jens?
Thank you, Sue. I do have two comments, or I would like to make two comments to the tentative agenda decision and the wording. At the end of passage one, I would like to propose that we amend the last sentence by early application is permitted to give this, to indicate that this is more, it's not a matter of 2023. But it could also be a matter of 2020 or 2021. So stating only that it is relevant for periods beginning on or after 1st of January 2023 is not enough for me. And then I have a second proposed insertion in passage 2, line 5. I think we discussed a lot about BC 48E. And I'd like to amend the text that is written there. So it reads like, when the right to defer settlement is subject to the entity complying with specified conditions. And now I would like to insert relating to an entity's financial position to make clear that we are not discussing entity's financial performance, but rather concentrate in the three cases on entity's financial position and then go on and compliance with the specified conditions. So these are my two proposals for insertions.
Okay, thank you.
Jens, maybe can I just come in on your...
Anytime.
On your thoughts. I suppose maybe I'll take your second one first. My only worry, if I understand correctly your second suggestion, to me that comes across in the cases, and I would only worry about inserting it. I think in those words we are actually quoting the words from IS1, you know, that talks about compliance with the specified conditions, blah, 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 and 72A. So I think I'd rather not insert it to the extent that we're quoting, you know, the words from IS1 and therefore not superimposing other words. And I mean, open to what committee members think about the early application as well, but I would think the early application comment is much more something that sits in the standard and is not necessarily needed in the tentative agenda decision, but that's just my initial reaction.
Well, I'm not sure it hurts, Katrina. We could just say, got that sentence that says it's effective. We could just add in with early application permitted. That would be fine.
Okay.
Mary, did you want to come in?
If Brian is commenting on Jens, do you want to skip to him?
You're going to chip in and be vice chair. Okay. Brian, would you like to come in?
Okay, just very quickly, I thought Jens's suggestion of referring to the fact that we have discussed almost exclusively conditions that depend on the entity's financial position, it seems it would be useful to have that somewhere in the agenda decision. I share Katrina's concern about putting it in the second paragraph, because that seems to make it kind of too general a comment. But I wondered if when we get to the cases, as part of the run-in to the cases, there could be something along the lines of the committee observed that when a condition relates to an entity's financial position, you know, the entity tests the covenant at the bank, you know, that kind of tee-up before we go into the detailed cases, because otherwise I think all of the how to do it stuff is within the cases themselves. So I just wondered if there's a case for having just one or two, kind of expanding the introduction to the cases to bring out the fact that we have been discussing conditions that depend on financial position.
Mary?
Yes.
Okay. About to express a personal view, and I'm going to express it as a caution rather than a suggestion for specific wording, is I think certainly the three cases that were in the paper and that are proposed for inclusion in the tentative agenda decision were very useful for this committee in terms of testing thinking and looking at how the wording in the amendments get operationalized, but several, and you know, particularly Guy, have said there's going to be basically a very large number of follow-up questions, and I think at some point the committee's going to have to say we've got enough examples that we're including at least in agenda decisions, because it's something the board faces too. You can't try and get to consistent application by answering every possible question. So I think it's going to be challenging to manage the number of examples that are in there. That's, you know, perhaps at this point, if committee members think it's been helpful to have all three for the discussion and you'd like to include those in the agenda decision, I won't lobby right now, but I will just express caution about going too far with the number of examples.
I'm just trying to think about what Mary just said. A few people did make the observation, though, along the way that they felt that there was some nuance in the differences. So, for example, the point that Bertrand raised about the scenario where the covenant changes from 1 to 1.1 or whatever the fact pattern was that we were looking at, I think the three cases are sort of bringing out slightly different nuances. So maybe if our objective is to sort of really bang people over the head with, you know, this is what the implications are, the three cases is helpful in doing that, unless board committee members think otherwise. So I'm going to get you to vote on the tentative agenda decision with a couple of amendments. So one is referring to the fact that the, in addition to the effective date, that the amendments are available for early application. And the other is to say that we maybe say the committee discussed three fact patterns that with loans with working capital ratios or something like that, just to set the scene that that was the specific thing we focused on. I think those were the two main changes I heard. Petrina, is there anything else I've missed?
I think there was Bertrand's comment as well that just said we just add something simple in the intro about to say, you know, this is in response to questions about application of the amendments.
Yep, sorry, forgot that. Yep. So with those three suggestions, can I get a show of hands from the committee on who agrees with the proposed wording in the tentative agenda decision?
Again, that looks like everyone.
Everybody,
yeah.
Brian in the chat box is agreeing as well. Okay. With that, I think maybe we'll take our break early if that suits people. I feel like that was quite an effort. So shall we take a break now for, was it 15 minutes, the allotted break time, Petrina?
Yes, 15 minutes.
Okay, so let's reconvene at 5 to 2 London time, so in 15 minutes. Thank you.